Good morning, everyone. On the matter of State versus Gabriel Garcia, may we please have appearances of counsel?
Marsha Bloom, Assistant Deputy Public Defender for Gabriel Garcia.
Good morning, Karen Your Honors, and may it please. Sorry.
Karen Thompson, an American Civil Liberties Union of New Jersey, a friend of the court.
Dylan McGuire, on behalf of Amicus Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, New Jersey.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Erin Campbell, Assistant Hudson County Prosecutor on behalf of the state.
Good morning, Your Honors. Deborah Bartolome, Deputy Attorney General, on behalf of the Attorney General, Amicus Curiae.
Good morning to all counsel and welcome. Ms. Bloom, please go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I may, I'd like to reserve a few minutes for rebuttal.
That's fine.
Thank you. This was a close case. Mr. Garcia presented a strong claim of self-defense. As the prosecutor stated in his summation, this would be in the June 15th transcript of page 130, this case comes down to which version of events you find credible. But Mr. Garcia was not allowed to present critical evidence in the form of a video that supported the credibility of the defense witnesses. The trial court ruling excluding the video wholly undermined the credibility of the defense witnesses, and the prosecutor took improper advantage of the exclusion of the video to make false and misleading statements that further undermine the credibility of the defense witnesses. Now, there were two points when the video was admissible. First, when the detective testified, and second, when the prosecutor cross-examined Mr. Garcia's mother. So first, when the detective testified, she told us she represented all the police officers at the scene. She told us that there were perhaps as many as 10 officers at the scene and that they were all investigating the scene. They were looking for evidence. They were looking for witnesses. And on cross-examination, after establishing that, the defense attorney tried to elicit that she didn't speak to any members of the defendant's family, to the defendant or any members of his family. The detective insisted that they developed only a single witness who saw everything, and that witness was the complainant's wife. And she repeatedly said, no other witnesses were found, no other witnesses were found. Well, at that point, the video would have rebutted the detective's testimony and would have shown that indeed Mr. Garcia's parents had come forward to the police at the scene. The video, as we argued and as the appellate division agreed, was not hearsay evidence because we were not asking that anything that was said on the video at that point should have been heard by the jury. They could have silenced the video. It was strictly the picture on the video that showed the parents trying to speak to the police. And in State v. Miller, this court said that video evidence presents a more complete picture. And indeed, in this case, as I hope the court has seen the video, you can see that a woman not in uniform with a notebook is within a few feet of where the defendant's parents are speaking to the police. And that is precisely how the detective was described in the transcript as a woman not in uniform with a notebook. So the video would not only have shown the picture that the parents were in fact speaking to the police, but that the detective was nearby and might well have seen them speaking to the police. At any rate, it certainly rebutted the detective's testimony that nobody else came forward. And she said, if anyone else had came forward, of course she would have spoken to them. Now, this was not tangential evidence. This was essential and critical evidence because the implication that if the defendant's parents didn't come forward at the scene, now 2 years later, after they hired an attorney, now they're telling us it's self-defense. So this would address the idea that the self-defense claim was a claim of recent fabrication. But then there was a second point when the video was admissible, and that's when the prosecutor cross-examined the defendant's mother. On direct examination, the defendant's parents both said, we tried to speak to the police at the scene. And I believe the stepfather said, but we were ignored. On cross-examination, the prosecutor tried to drill down on that. And he asked the mother repeatedly, you understood who the detective was at the scene. And he described the detective, as I said, a woman with a notebook. And Mr. Garcia's mother agreed that she understood who the detective was at the scene. And the implication was, well, maybe she spoke to the police, but she certainly didn't speak to the detective. Well, the video would have explained why the parents didn't speak to the detective. At that point, the video was admissible to explain that. And I had cited in my brief case, El Sufi versus St. Peter's Hospital, but the Attorney General also cited that case. And I think I'm going to, if I may, on page 29 of the Attorney General's brief, they drill down on State v. El Sufi. And I think that explains precisely why it would have been admissible at that point when the prosecutor was cross-examining the mom. The AG says, a statement is not inadmissible hearsay, and now they quote from El Sufi, where statements are offered not for the truthfulness of their content, but only to show that they were in fact made and that the listener took certain action as a result thereof. Well, in this case, the video showed why the parents didn't take certain action as a result thereof. The parents didn't go to the detective because the police officers told them, now is not the time, take it to court. So the uniform representatives of the Jersey City Police Department told the parents, now is not the time to talk to the police, you take that to court. So that went a long way to explain why the parents didn't go to press on after the police told them to take it to the court, why they didn't press on and insist on trying to talk to the detective. The exclusion of the video completely undermined the parents' credibility. The court instructed on credibility. The court told the jury, as they were entitled to say under the model charge, that you have to consider the bias of the witness. You have to consider whether their interest in the outcome of the case. And frankly, I assume that even without the instruction, the jury would have had some skepticism about the credibility of the defendant's parents. But then after the instruction on considering bias of the witness, the court gave the false in one, false in all instruction. So in other words, the jury was given license that if you don't believe the parents that they went to the police at the scene, then you don't have to believe the parents when they testified that the defendant acted in self-defense. So if the state was allowed to attack the parents' credibility as to whether they went to the police at all, which they were, and the defense was not allowed to rehabilitate their witnesses, then the jury had a green light to disbelieve everything the parents said. The omission of the video was critical to the credibility of the parents, and the parents were critical to the credibility of the self-defense claim. And that's essentially my argument for point one as to why it's reversible error and prejudicial error. It was both wrong on the law to exclude the video, and it was highly prejudicial to exclude the video. And if I may, I would continue on to the second point as to why the prosecutor's argument about the exclusion of the video went beyond the bounds of fair comment, and to quote the U.S. Supreme Court in Berger, struck foul blows. And the prosecutor's argument with respect to the video was at the June 15th transcript, and I believe the really objectionable portion start on page 141, where the prosecutor mocks essentially the parents' testimony, where they say, he says, the family's outside and they're supposedly out there and nobody cares what they have to say. So the prosecutor is saying, they told you that the parents told you that the police didn't want to hear what they have to say. And he was taking unprincipled advantage of the fact that the video was excluded, which would have shown that indeed the parents did try to speak to the police and they were told, take it to court. We're not interested in hearing what you have to say at this time. But then the prosecutor essentially went further than that, because first he was attacking whether the parents, whether the police actually told the parents, we're not interested in what you have to say. But having established that foundation, now he made an even greater attack, and he's questioning whether the parents went to the police at all, not whether the police shut them down, but whether they went to the police at all. And he says on page 142, and I think that's on line 7, if this really happened like that, in other words, if the defendant acted in self-defense, you running out there, referring to the parents, you running out there for your son, you're going to tell the people, the police at the scene, the detectives at the scene, those charged with investigation, that no, there's something else going on here. But she never did, referring to the mom, and he says it twice, but she never did, and that should rule large in your mind. The video would have rebutted all of those things. The prosecutor knew the video wasn't coming in, and he took unprincipled advantage of the exclusion of the video to paint a dishonest picture of what went on. Again,
Ms. Blum, just to put a fine point on it, your position is, in summation, it was not simply misleading, it was outright false for the prosecutor.
I believe,
to make that statement.
I believe, Your Honor, that some of the statements were outright false. But
just wanted to understand your position. Thank you.
Let me qualify. But prosecutorial misconduct is not based on whether the prosecutor lied. Prosecutorial misconduct is not a prerequisite for finding prosecutorial misconduct. Merely being misleading, merely presenting an inaccurate picture of what went on when he knew it was inaccurate is sufficient. As I said, foul blows are enough. So even if the court finds that no one sentence was, you know, a false, I believe the court should and has to find that it was misleading, that he took unprincipled advantage of the exclusion of the video to paint a misleading picture for the jury. And again, as I said earlier, with respect to the first point, not on a tangential issue, on an essential issue as to credibility.
Thank you for that qualification.
Sure. The court doesn't have any other questions. I'd like to sort of close with reminding us about Crane v. Kentucky, the United States Supreme Court case, which talks about the Constitution guarantees criminal defendants a meaningful opportunity to present a complete defense. But the court says that opportunity would be an empty one if the state were permitted to exclude competent, reliable evidence when such evidence is central to the defendant's claim of innocence. And in this case, not only was Mr. Garcia denied the opportunity to present reliable evidence that was central to his claim of innocence, but then the prosecutor exploited the omission of the evidence. And essentially, the credibility, with the defendant's ability to defend the credibility of his witnesses was just cut off at the knees with the exclusion of the video. And we're saying that it's highly prejudicial, and we're asking the court to reverse.
Questions, anyone? Thank you, Ms. Blum. I'm gonna ask all counsel who are not presenting to please mute until you present. We'll hear next from Ms. Thompson. A couple of attorneys need to mute.
Good morning, and may it please the court. As Ms. Blum already pointed out, this is a very, very close case. There are two conflicting versions of an incident, and the jury had to choose which one to credit. I'd like to drill down a little bit on how that process denied Mr. Garcia his right to a fair trial. Specifically, we're focusing on the false statement that the prosecutor noted in his summation regarding the Garcia's reaching out to the police. But that statement was also embedded in additional layers of bias to prop it up. And this starts at the very instant of law enforcement showing up at the scene. The police officers there decided almost immediately that Mr. Garcia was the favored suspect. That is the bias in deciding that he was guilty before speaking to him, before fleshing out much about the case, undermined the truth-finding process from the very, very beginning. Mr. Garcia was immediately arrested. He's told that his protestations of innocence would make things worse for him. And when the detective speaks to the Urbanski, she decides right away that the case is cut and dry and that she knows who the victim is. That what this does is it transfers law enforcement's own bias. It transfers the lack of investigation, the confirmation bias, into somehow the Garcia's moral failing. The prosecution interprets that kind of wall of rebuffing the Garcias as evidence of their inability to be credible. And this also plays out later on in the prosecution's summation. We've been talking very much about the incident with the video, but on page 145 of the transcript, and I do want to read this at length, the prosecutor says, "I'm asking you to make another credibility determination, to size up the Urbanskis in this case. Ask yourself this, were they the type of people..."
Can I ask you a question, ma'am?
Yes.
When the police arrived, there was a person bleeding and one wasn't bleeding, he was severely cut. Is that biased or is that police experience that if you have someone bleeding and someone's not, usually the person who committed that caused the bleeding is the person who's the potential defendant or potential person who committed the crime. Is that absolutely bias, or is that just police technique?
And well, I think
with respect to this bias, other than the fact that Mr. Garcia was Hispanic, what proof do you have that there was bias and affected the entire investigation system? We're not talking about the prosecutor's statements at trial or the hearsay. I'm talking about at the scene, which is what you're talking about. You're saying that there was bias and that's why it was investigated. That. What proof of that do you have?
Well, I think there are two different kinds of bias that are at play. And the one that I'm speaking about with regard to the scene is the confirmation bias that Mr. Garcia had caused the injury. And nobody knew that. Nobody had actually spoken to Mr. Garcia. It was all based on Mr. Urbanski's word. And his word was complicated, right? The facts of the case don't show that this was clear cut. Mr. Garcia had left the scene.
At the scene, his words weren't complicated. He said, the gentleman attacked me.
Right, but Mr. Garcia would have said that.
The later facts developed more detail, more breadth to this. But initially, all they had was a statement from someone bleeding that the other individual attacked them. So at that point, how's the bias come in?
Well, the bias is not making any ever additional efforts to determine if that was in fact true. And since Mr. Garcia's account was that he was actually attacked by Mr. Urbanski, I think that by ending it right there and arresting him and also saying that any effort to defend his position or present his recitation of facts would make it worse for him shows that the police weren't actually interested in tweezing out that information. And I think that's underscored by the behavior of Detective Dominic, who doesn't even bother to speak to the Garcias. This incident happens, you know, in stages. One of the stages happens on the actual porch of the Garcia home. Nobody attempts to speak to them about what unfurled there, and the police actually tell them to save any further information for the court. And I do want to read this little bit about the summation, because I think that goes directly to your point, Justice Fernandez-Vina, by saying, were these the type of people who try to come in and pull the wool over your eyes? And this is the prosecutor referring to the Urbanskis. Are these the type of people to lie about this? For what purpose? What would
especially,
they have to
man, be? That was a trial. That prosecutor is a whole different issue. I'm not taking issue with you on that. I'm talking about the investigation stuff. The closing statement has nothing to do with the investigation.
Well, I do believe that this was the closing statement did kind of go back and incorporate the bias that is being shown in the investigation at that moment.
So the prosecutor adopted the bias that was shown at the investigation. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. And and by giving that to the jury, by presenting that to the jury, by saying, look, you know, they're not talking to the police, he's actually kind of doubling down on the law enforcement, shutting down the kind of open mind to what actually occurred to be a moral issue with the Garcias. And by saying that the Urbanskis were not the type of people to lie, this doesn't become about what they say. It doesn't become about how they act. It doesn't become about their testimony. It becomes about who they are. And so the Garcias and Urbanskis are divided into two groups, the type of people who hide things, the type of people who lie, the type of people who sweep people up in a horrible, vicious attack. That's the words of the prosecutor, and those who don't. And the Urbanskis are immediately believed. They're believed by the police, despite the fact that the Urbanskis never call the police. Mr. Garcia calls the police, his family calls the police. They're believed despite the fact that Mr. Urbanski initiates contact. They're believed despite the fact that Mr. Urbanski approaches Mr. Garcia with another man.
Ms. Thompson,
I'm
sorry to interrupt you. We understand your position on bias as you've articulated it, and we have the transcript. Tell us the remedy in this case you are seeking, the specific remedy.
I believe that Mr. Garcia is entitled to a new trial because the depth of how this bias colored what the jury saw, what the jury heard, surrounded by this essential misconduct, which is to say that the Garcias were incredible, that they were lying, was only deepened by all of these additional layers of the issues with the investigation and the kind of moral failure that is put on the Garcias.
Is it your position that aside from the question of the admissibility of the video and the comments in summation that defense counsel argued just moments ago, the bias that you've identified as a basis for overturning the conviction alone?
I don't believe that it necessarily has to be considered alone, but I don't necessarily believe that they're indivisible. When the jury is hearing all of this information, it colors how they're making the choice. And in a case like this, where they're deliberating on the question of two stories, on whose story is more believable, their ability to make that deliberation, they're forced to lean into kind of their basest self by engaging with these forms of bias. And so that colors the way that they are making their decisions, the way they're interpreting the facts that are presented to them. And to the point that, to the extent that the video would shine truth and light on the fact that the Garcias reached out to the police, it also shines the light on the kind of bias in being rebuffed by the police in having their story be heard as well. So these issues, while they seem tangential.
What was the composition of the jury, counsel?
I am not sure of that. I actually did ask Ms. Blum that myself because I did want to know. And maybe she can answer in her rebuttal in the time that she is remaining. But when we talk about these issues, there's a patina that they put over the facts of the case. And when we appeal to these base instincts, the bias doesn't remain harmless. It creates unjust conditions for defendants. And it permeates how justice is able to be done. And so while it's not the only factor, while it's not perhaps even the most egregious issue in the misconduct, it can't be easily separated from.
Counsel, to be clear, the bias that you're arguing is confirmation bias. On the scene, the police declared that the defendant was guilty and the Urbanskys were the victim, and therefore shut down the defendant's parents from coming forward and giving their account at the time. And once being denied that, then the prosecutor exploited that factor in summation. That's basically your argument. Am I mistaken?
Yes. Okay. Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Justice.
Anything you'd like to add?
That's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. McGuire.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. In the interest of efficiency, I would adopt and incorporate the arguments of my colleagues and focus just briefly on the prosecutorial misconduct and cumulative error points in our brief. The ACDL urges this court to reaffirm the important holdings in State v. Ross and State v. Sexton that prosecutors cannot make statements that are clearly contrary to evidence of which they have knowledge, whether or not it's ultimately admitted or excluded. This principle goes to the heart of a criminal defendant's due process rights to present a complete defense and to have a fair trial. And when a prosecutor is permitted to make comments like this, you know, really to argue to the jury that they can reject a defense witness's testimony when there's a video that shows that they were telling the truth, really undermines the defendant's right to a fair trial. And this court has consistently said that prosecutors are held to a high standard, and for good reason. They have a ton of power, and they have the responsibility to wield it fairly. And when you allow a prosecutor to make these types of comments, it really, in a case as close as this, where credibility is the key issue, it undermines the defendant's right to a fair trial. And I won't belabor the point, but when we look at the series of errors that occurred in this case, you know, it really does have to, you have to look at the thematic effect of what happened here. The video was excluded. The prosecutor was then permitted to urge the jury to reject the family's testimony that they came forward, that they tried to tell the police that, you know, our son did act in self-defense. And I think an important aspect of that, looking at the Attorney General's brief, they lay out the transcription of the video. And one of the comments that the police officer makes is, if he did nothing wrong, he wouldn't have left. And I think a jury could reasonably infer from that statement that the family had in fact said he was acting in self-defense. There's no other explanation of why the officer would make that type of statement. And the fact that the jury didn't get to see that really caused a huge error here for the defendant. And we asked the court to reverse this conviction and reaffirm the principle that prosecutors cannot make comments like that when they know of evidence that stands for something otherwise.
Thank you, Mr. McGuire. Ms. Campbell.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. At trial, the state's proof showed beyond a reasonable doubt that in the early morning hours of September 11th, 2016, this defendant slashed Raymond Urbanski from ear to mouth with a box cutter. The eyewitnesses to that slashing were Urbanski, his wife Jennifer, and his brother-in-law Jason. Defendant then fled the scene with the box cutter, which was never seen again. It's important to note that this video wasn't produced until after the state rested at trial. And this video purported to show the defendant's family speaking with police at the scene. It's uncontested that those family members didn't see how the confrontation started. And it's also uncontested that defendant left the safety of his vehicle to confront Urbanski. The appellate division here upheld the exclusion of the video. The video here is irrelevant and at risk confusing and misleading the jury. In fact, the trial court said that it was concerned that this video was not relevant to anything. And the court asked repeatedly, both of defense counsel and rhetorically, this comes in under which rule and for what purpose? And importantly, defense counsel was never able to articulate a rule under which the video could be admitted into evidence. This video did not help the defendant's self-defense claim because it wasn't even taken until after the incident was over. There is apparently a video within the video of the victim threatening the defendant's family. But according to the testimony of both his sister and his mother, that didn't occur until after the defendant had left the scene. It didn't contradict the testimony of Detective Dominich. It shows Dominich at the end of the video walking around with her notebook and the family ignoring her. What the video showed was a piece of an interaction between the defendant's family and the patrol officers, excuse me. And that's confusing and potentially misleading under 403 because there's no context for it. It picks up in the middle of a sentence where the patrol officer is stating, defenses are for court. We don't know what preceded that, for how long it was happening, or for how long it continued. Additionally, the information in that video was potentially damaging to defendant's case. The family told police that they had a video showing Ray making threats, but to this day they've never produced it. The family stated in the video that the sister called 911, and the officers in the video refuted that. The state made additional arguments as to why the video was inadmissible, that it was excluded by the hearsay rule as a prior consistent statement, that it was cumulative, and it was not properly authenticated. Here, the appellate division incorrectly found that the video was not hearsay because it wasn't offered for its truth. But the video is offered for the truth, that the family approached law enforcement with their version of the story, and they were, to quote, mom pushed away, and to quote, dad, totally ignored. In order for the video to bolster their credibility, its contents must be true. Therefore, the trial court properly found that the hearsay rule was triggered and the video must come in under an exception. The video does not rebut the testimony of Detective Dominich. She testified that she neither found nor was made aware of other witnesses at the scene. The video doesn't refute that. Furthermore, it's important to note that defendant's mother testified on direct examination that Detective Dominich was an investigator. She was tasked with investigating this crime. Mom testified that she knew what a detective was, and that a detective was different from a patrol officer. She additionally testified that she saw Dominich taking a statement from Jennifer Urbanski, but that she did not approach Dominich herself. The video is cumulative, and testimony may not be repeated to show that a witness's version remains intact. That's what we have here. The only effect of admitting this video would be to bolster the witness's credibility. Additionally, the video was not properly authenticated at the 104 hearing. Mr. Salgado never laid a foundation for how he recognized the voices on the film. He was never asked if that video fairly and accurately depicted his recollection or if the video had been edited in any way. Additionally, Salgado testified through an interpreter that he didn't understand English. No one ever asked if he understood the content of the video. No valid reason was offered for this video's admission, and it was properly excluded by the trial court. Additionally, the appellate division properly found that there was no error in excluding it. It didn't go to the self-defense claim. The events on the video were testified to at trial, and therefore, in the context of the entire trial, the defendant was not prejudiced by its exclusion.
Counsel, did the video show, in fact, that the family did approach, regardless of what, if it was, even if it was placed if shown silent with no comments, it showed that the family had approached the police, and it negated the statement by the prosecutor that they never approached the police. And that's not a hearsay issue. That simply shows, corroborates that they did approach the police and were turned away. So that would be a hearsay argument. That would not fall under 803C3 or any of the other rules, 804. It would simply show that they approached the police and the police had no record of anything that they approached them or saying that, in fact, they didn't approach them. Would that be admissible simply to show that, which is to support?
You know, Your Honor, I think it becomes even less relevant if you play it without the sound. They could have been talking to the police about anything. Mom had testified
Wouldn't they? The argument by the prosecutors, they never approached the police. Whether they were talking about the weather or what they were having for dinner, they did approach the police. So at least it had an effect of negating that argument from the prosecutor that they never approached the police. So it would be relevant to that, wouldn't it?
Your Honor, the import of the argument that they never approached the police was that the police were uninterested in hearing the other side of the story. If we watch the video on silent, they could have been talking about anything.
That's what I'm saying. It doesn't matter. They were still talking to the police, and the prosecutor said they never approached the police. It would have negated that comment, would it not?
And, Your Honor, that comment in context, I think this is an issue of the coldness of the transcript, for lack of a better word. When we look at this statement in context, if this really happened, you running out here, there for your son, you're going to tell the people, the police, and then the prosecutor corrects himself and says, the detectives at the scene, those charged with this investigation.
Counsel. It seems your adversaries are saying you made it relevant. You are arguing that the family didn't cooperate. That's what you argued. And yet you kept out the very evidence. You argued to keep out the evidence that would show that they were attempting to cooperate. And part of the transcript was in the exchange, go to court, bring your evidence to court. No one was taking the mother, the father, the sister to Dominich. They were telling, go to court. So that's the argument. You kept it out, then you exploited it. What's your response to that?
Your Honor, I would argue that the prosecutor didn't exploit it. The defense summation focused entirely on the one-sided nature of this investigation. The defense summation ignored the fact that police come to this crime scene, they see a man with his face slashed open from ear to mouth, the defendant's gone, he's nowhere to be seen.
That's their argument for confirmation bias. You know, you find one person and you decide the other person's guilty. Now the defense is arguing you should have been canvassing and taking statements from everyone and not later claiming that the family didn't cooperate when, in fact, the video indicates otherwise. Go ahead.
Your Honor, I think the difference between the video and the testimony here is that Mom testified she knew who Dominich was. She knew why she was there. She saw Dominich taking these statements. She knew Dominich was the one charged with investigating, and she made no effort to approach.
I'm having trouble with this argument that the family at the scene has to talk to this specific person. There's many law enforcement officers at the scene. We have the video showing that they were standing there speaking to several law enforcement officers. So because they did not speak to the specific detective that was tasked with this investigation, that negates the fact that they did speak to the police. I mean, I don't know how that argument is persuasive. The video refutes what Dominich says, that there was no one else around, that no one else approached the law enforcement. Isn't that right?
Well, Your Honor, I read Dominich's testimony as no one approached her. And the import of this is that the Garcias knew who to approach and they chose not to. I believe the appellate division found that it was a fair inference to draw that they didn't approach the right person because they didn't have the right information to offer.
So it doesn't matter that they're talking to police on the scene. They're talking to law enforcement officers on the scene, and those law enforcement officers tell them, this is not the time, wait to get to court. They're told, don't talk, we don't want to talk about this any longer. Isn't that correct? Oh. Isn't that what happens in the video? The officer tells them, this is not the time.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor. And I would argue that the police aren't there to determine whether or not the defendant has a valid claim of self-defense. That is for court. And again, this is just a 1 minute piece of whatever happened there. I mean, it starts mid-sentence from the officer. We don't know when this interaction started and we don't know when it ended. We just have this little piece in there of the victim,
That video explains why the mother didn't go to Dominich. She didn't go to Dominich because the police officer was saying, take it to court. And yet Dominich is then going to say, oh, no one's coming to me. No one's talking to me. When the video is explaining why the mother and the father are not speaking to her because they were told to go somewhere else. Am I wrong about that?
Your Honor, it doesn't explain why she didn't go to Dominich in the first place, knowing who Dominich was and why she was there.
Is that the way it's supposed to, is that the protocol now? When you're a witness and the police are there, you ask for the highest ranking member who's in charge of the investigation, that's the person you speak to. And if you speak to anyone else, then it doesn't count. Is that the protocol?
It is not, Your Honor, but in this case, the mother volunteered on direct that she knew who Dominich was and what her purpose was in being at that scene.
So
she saw Dominich taking statements from other witnesses.
You understand the police hierarchy, who's in charge, and then you go to the highest person. Because if you speak to the police officer, you understand that that doesn't matter because you have to speak to the detective in charge or the lead investigator or the highest rank officer. Is that what citizens are required to do now?
No, Your Honor. It's the state's position that mom knew who to talk to and deliberately chose not to speak with her. Because mom understood the hierarchy at that scene, she should have spoken to Detective Dominich, knowing who she was and why she was there.
That's not the argument that's not the argument the line prosecutor made in summation. When you quoted the passage earlier, you added something that the prosecutor corrected himself. Let's look at what was actually said. You're going to tell the people, the police at the scene, the detectives at the scene, but she never did. Yeah. Is that an accurate statement? Was that a proper statement to make to the jury?
I submit that it was, Your Honor. He clarified and he said the detectives at the scene, those charged with investigating, which mom had testified, she understood to mean Detective Dominich.
So you're in effect editing the transcript as I see it, looking at it cold, because he doesn't repudiate the statement, mom never spoke to the police. You're just asking that we focus on the latter half. No?
I am asking, Your Honors, to focus on the latter half. Says the people, the police at the scene, and then the detectives, those charged with investigating, which mom testified she understood to mean Dominich.
So if we read the language as it appears, mm-hmm. is it inappropriate in this case for the prosecutor to have argued mom never spoke to the police at the scene?
Mom did speak to the police in the video. However, she didn't speak to the person that she knew to be investigating. And that's the difference here.
Counsel, you mentioned that this was not offered for its truth, and it was offered for its truth, and it was therefore hearsay. I want to ask you about that, because if in fact the defendant was seeking to offer this video for whatever, and the video to me doesn't really tell you too clearly what's being said, but that it was the defendant wanted whatever the mother was saying to the officer to be offered for its truth, I would be with you on that. But I got to tell you, this is not, the statements within the video are not offered for their truth as far as I can tell. What they are being offered for is the fact that there was an attempt to communicate. Why is that hearsay, as the trial court seemed to think it was?
Because, Your Honor, the import of the statements depends on their credibility. That the daughter had been calling 911. Well, no, she wasn't. That there's this video within the video of the victim threatening the defendant's family. That video's never materialized.
I understand why it goes to credibility, but hearsay by definition is something that is mm-hmm. offered for the truth of the matter asserted. If it's not in that category, it's You don't even have to get to exceptions to the hearsay rule. So this is being offered for the fact that there was an approach to police, but not offered, as I understand it, for the truth of any statements that may have been made to the police on that occasion. Did you agree with that distinction? Why is it hearsay?
Your Honor, I would argue that it's hearsay because in order to bolster the witness's credibility, the contents of that video have to be true.
But that would loop in virtually any credibility information as hearsay. I just respectfully disagree with that. I would be 100% with you if the defendant said, I'm seeking to admit this video because you can hear the mother, and you know, again, I think having watched the video, it's a little unclear exactly what was said, but you can hear the mother giving an account of the event, and that is the true account, and therefore we want this video in there, and then you have to look at whether it's within an exception, but that's not what they were seeking to do, and that really isn't what the video does for them anyway. What it does show is at least, you know, a couple of officers, one speaking to the woman who was identified as the mother, interacting and very clearly saying, you have to take it to court. I don't remember exact words, but it's something along those lines.
Understood, Your Honor. And I think we have to keep in mind that when defense counsel presented this video, she had no idea why it came in. And the trial court repeatedly asked her, for what purpose does this video come in and under what rule? And that was never articulated by defense counsel. The trial court was essentially left to its own devices to try to figure out under which framework that it should be analyzed. And this was what he settled on.
But the other approach is it was offered to meet a charge of recent fabrication. Part of the cross-examination of the defense witnesses, you went to the attorney. There was this whole suggestion that this defense was concocted after the fact, and the defense was offering the video to show, they wanted to speak on day one at the moment with the police. So that is an alternate theory. Why is that not any good?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think it provides an alternate theory because the cross-examination of mom was so narrow because she had volunteered on direct that she knew who Dominich was and why she was there. Video doesn't refute that.
You concentrate on that. So that's like the one piece that should be considered and everything else disregarded. But she was questioned, about her relationship. You would do anything to help your son. I mean, the typical questions that are asked of parents, that their testimony should be disregarded because of their relationship. And plus that they were also asked, didn't you speak with the attorney? Suggesting that, the attorney somehow helped create some sort of defense. They want this video to show, before any attorney, this is what they wanted to do. They wanted to tell their story to the police. Well, why doesn't that come in as, and even under the evidence rule, as
Judge, that bias still existed on September 11th, 2016, when they went to talk to police. Mom testified that she was upset that they wouldn't let her see her son. And I'm not quite sure, again, because this is just a piece of the interaction that they had with police that night, when this comes up that they're speaking with them.
Look, that's your argument. No one's saying that you can't make it. You can make your bias argument, beginning, the end, summation. Mm-hmm. They want a chance to present their case as well. That's where it is. No? They don't have a right to present their case?
Judge, they did present their case. They presented five different witnesses to testify as to what happened, and those witnesses were horribly inconsistent with one another, inconsistencies which were pointed out in summation at far greater length than was given to this. The family didn't talk to the detective issue.
But counsel, if testimony or a video becomes cumulative simply because there was some narrative testimony on it, then wouldn't that substantially undercut the ability to use video testimony? when I look at the transcript, defense counsel plainly said he wanted to, quote, support their assertion that the police officer did not want to take their statement. And the video went directly to support that line of argument. To then pile on a cumulative argument, cumulative evidence argument, substantially impacts the defense, I think.
Well, Your Honor, I don't want to put too fine a point on it, but it's cumulative because the witness's version that they did not speak to the right person wasn't challenged. The video would just bolster what they had testified to.
You can make that argument in summation, but the defense can still argue that the family did try to speak to law enforcement representatives.
Is there anything you'd like to add to your presentation, Ms. Campbell?
Your Honor, I'd like to address the prosecutorial misconduct briefly, if I may. The appellate division here properly found that the prosecutor's comments countered defense counsel's arguments that the investigation was one-sided. As I've stated, her closing was fairly brief. It focused on Dominich's testimony that she spoke with the Urbanskys and no one else. She misstated that Ray went to the car ready to fight. She called Ray's credibility into question and referenced his demeanor, which is where we get this response from the prosecutor to which the ACLU referred. She called defense witnesses very credible and consistent, and she put the weight of the bias accusations on Dominich. The prosecutor's closing was much more lengthy and broad. And as the appellate division found, it's a fair inference to draw that the defendant's mother didn't speak to Dominich because she had no information favorable to defendant to offer. The prosecutor here highlighted the numerous inconsistencies in the defense witness's testimony. Were there two, three, four, or five attackers? Because each defense witness testified differently. Was mom pushed or wasn't she? And at what point did that happen? The video that was excluded didn't speak to any of this, and it didn't clarify any of the inconsistencies that the prosecutor highlighted. In fact, it disproved none of the statements made by the prosecutor. The prosecutor confined his testimony to confined his comments to testimony elicited through proper cross-examination, and as a response to the argument by trial counsel that the charges against defendant were the result of a biased, incomplete investigation. The jury here was free to disregard any inferences the prosecutor was urging them to draw. And importantly, defense counsel never objected to this testimony at trial. If counsel doesn't object, the remarks will generally not be deemed prejudicial because it suggests that defense counsel didn't believe they were prejudicial at the time they were made. The absence of a contemporaneous objection can lead to a fair inference that in the context of the entire trial, the statement was of no moment. It additionally deprives the court of an opportunity to take curative action. Even if this court were to find that it was misconduct, it does not rise to the level of plain error. It was not clearly and unmistakably improper, so egregious that it deprives a defendant of the right to have his jury fairly evaluate the merits of his defense. As argued, the video had no impact on the defendant's self-defense claim. And here, the summation focused on, one, the absurdity of defendant's story, and two, the inconsistencies in the different versions to which his family testified, neither of which was refuted by the video. The excluded evidence neither supports his self-defense claim nor cures the numerous material inconsistencies in his family's testimony. The state would ask this court to affirm the holding of the lower courts as well as the defendant's conviction.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Bartolome. Ms. Bartolome, you're muted. Thank you.
Thanks. I would like to ask the court to look at the summation comment in context with the prior paragraph, because the prosecutor is very clearly pointing out that he is making a distinction between police officers on the scene and speaking to the detective. And by doing that, he's as much as saying, yes, they did talk to the police, but they should have spoken to the detective. And the reason that he's saying that is that the detective testified that when she got to the scene, she was walking around saying, did anybody see this? Did anybody see this? And no one came up to her except the person she talked to. She talked to the Urbanskys and she talked to Mrs. Urbanski. But no one in defendant's family came up when urged to. Had they seen it, were they an eyewitness? So that is why, and then the prosecutor said to the mother, after she had said on direct, oh, I knew who the detective was. I knew she was the one investigating. I knew she was the one taking statements. And he said, You knew that, but you never went up to the detective. Now, that's the point he's trying to make, because in the prior paragraph, he says, I want to emphasize to you that I think is relevant to figure out what happened here, that the mother knew the difference between police officer and detective. She knew police officers don't have the same role, and on and on. And then in the next paragraph, he says, police at the scene, detectives at the scene, which I believe in context, that means he's correcting himself, because that is the point he's making. He never said that the Urbanskys did not talk to the police.
You're suggesting this is a slip of the tongue and nothing
yes,
more.
It's, and we have cases that say that. One word to just home in on that and seize upon that and say that he's saying something, which, you know, if he wouldn't be distinguishing between police officers and detectives if he didn't acknowledge that they spoke to police officers at the scene. So we don't need this video to show that. And also the summation is responsive to what the defense summation was, which is this was actually a mob attack, defendant defended himself, but they didn't want to hear about it. The police did not.
Now, you're making such a fine point. If your view were correct, why wouldn't the prosecutor have said, oh yeah, the family went to the police, they spoke with the police, but they didn't speak with the detective? I mean, that would have really made it clear if that's the case. And then that would have taken the sting out of it. But the fact is, you successfully kept out the video, and then the suggestion is they didn't cooperate at all. And in fact, and I think the Chief Justice read this at the beginning, and then again, the families all, or one of the counsel, and then again, the families all outside, and they're supposedly out there, nobody cares what they have to say. It's almost like a mocking reference that, yeah, if they had something to say, the police officers would have taken it down. And then we have the other parts that are quoted. So how do you respond to that?
Well, I would say, Your Honor, that you're reading the record. It isn't as if we know how he said it. And he's also saying this in response to a defense summation, which is saying they wouldn't listen to our story. And then as far as this video goes, the video does not support the defense. There's no mention in this video. Here's the mother and the stepfather and the sister. And the sister admitted she wasn't outside during this event. But the mother and the stepfather both testified that they were surrounded by an armed mob. And yet not one word about any armed mob. They point to a video that was taken of the victim after the fact running around angry, bleeding, making threats to the family. Yet they never even bring that video in. So what is the jury to think about that? I mean, to me, if anything, this refutes the defense, because if you're there right after the fact and your son was mobbed by a gang of angry armed men and you don't even mention it to these officers, and that's another thing, this claim that the officers didn't take them seriously.
What story could they have given? They were repeatedly told, take the story to court. They were basically saying, don't bother us. I don't want to hear this. Take this to court. You got a defense, take it to court. Like, why would they go on any further? I don't understand your argument.
Your Honor, I watched the video several times, and what I saw were two police officers very patiently listening to citizens, discussing what they said, maybe not agreeing with what they said. Obviously, the one officer was very skeptical that they called the police and said, oh, we got one call on this. But they were talking to the people, engaging with the people. Now, when they pointed to this video, now remember, the sister had testified that two officers actually had watched the video, but they weren't very impressed by it.
Ms. Bartol, isn't it true that not only did the detective not, in her testimony, not reflect that the family spoke to her, but also the police reports did not indicate that the family had spoken to the police, just as the family was trying to say they did at trial. So don't we have two pieces of evidence in the state's case that's trying to push this narrative that the defense was trying to respond to by use of the video?
I think, Your Honor, when I see it, I see the defense saying, you didn't want to talk to us or hear about us or hear what we had to say. And maybe the family came forward, but what were they talking about? They were talking about who was going to put defendant's car in the driveway, who called the police, and that was a little back and forth. Not once do we have any indication that anyone in defendant's family talked about this mob attacking him.
But isn't it true that the police reports do not contain any reference to the conversations with the family?
Well, I assume, I don't know, I haven't seen them, but I would assume that there was nothing, at least in this video that we saw, that would make its way into police report necessarily, because they're focused on who is the victim and who is the perpetrator. And they get
and
there.
That's not relevant to an investigation, a statement from someone in the area as to who is the victim, who is the perpetrator. You don't think that's relevant to the investigation?
I don't think it's relevant when they come forward and they say, we called the police. And when the police are saying, no, you didn't call the police. They weren't eyewitnesses. We know that because
how do we know that? Because the police said they weren't?
Because Detective Domenech.
Detective there to see who witnessed it?
That's what she said. Did anybody see
it? Was there already when the incident took place? Is that what you're saying? The detective was standing by and observed it?
No, Your Honor. What I'm saying is...
That's what you were saying to me.
Oh, I'm sorry. What I meant to say was when the detective got to the scene, she went around soliciting eyewitness accounts and none were forthcoming from anybody in defendant's family. And they, and let's also put this in the context of... I saw the state's exhibits, the photographs of the defendant and of the victim that night. And I have to say that this is what the jury saw. And that the victim's face is pretty horrific. He was horribly cut up and, you know, and wounded, whereas the defendant had like a little mark on his head. So that also informs the judgment of the police.
Have you ever seen someone started a fight and lost it?
No, I don't know. The most injured
person doesn't necessarily have to be the victim. Sometimes the most injured person starts a fight and then loses it.
Well, that is possible.
That's a problem.
And they gave all their testimony. They talked about this mob, talked about how defendant was chased down the street. Every person that came in on defendant's side had a different number. You know, the stories were pretty incredible. The jury was able to assess, I think, based on all the testimony, to which this was responsive, this summation.
Ms. Bartolome, there's a passage in the video. It's a very short video, all of 1 minute and 2 seconds, as I recall. There's a passage, I believe, in which the defendant's stepfather says, what happened, this guy, that shorter guy over there, he got a knife. Is it your position that's inculpating or exculpating the defendant? Does that bear on self-defense?
To me, that I thought that what he was saying, that he said he is going to kill the whole family. There's like four words. He got a knife, that shorter guy. I thought what he was saying, what it seems like to me, is that the victim was saying that the defendant had a knife and that he was going to kill the whole defendant's family. And let's put this in context.
Shouldn't the jury have been allowed to do that instead of you? You weren't on the jury. Shouldn't that have gone to the jury for their assessment of credibility instead of facts, not you? I understand what you thought, but shouldn't that have gone to the jury to decide?
It was irrelevant, Your Honor, and it brings out so many problems.
How is it irrelevant? Since you just gave us some dissertation on what you thought it meant and how it helps the case, and now you're telling me it's irrelevant. You can't have it both ways, Counselor.
I was just responding to His Honor's question about what the video meant in that place, but I think over at all, I see nothing that goes to self-defense in that video. I see the parents of the defendant are talking. They're saying things to the police. The police are responding to them. And if they're trying to say, oh, well, they told us to go away. The police didn't tell them to go away. The police officer says, let's stop. Take it to court.
Counsel, let's stop right there. So I'm looking at page 94 of the transcript of the video. I'm just going to read part, and I want you to comment about it.
Okay. And
it's the stepfather.
Is that,
Mr.
Canales, I'm sorry.
I'm going to read it.
Okay.
I got a record for the calling, I got a video of this guy saying he's killing, and then it's parenthetical, indiscernible police. Okay. You take that to court. Take that to court when you go to court. When you go to court, you take it to court. What this guy say? Okay. And then this guy, no comment, and just take it to court. They don't say, take it to Detective Dominich, who supposedly is conducting the investigation, take it to court. And then later in the summation, the prosecutor is suggesting, hey, they weren't cooperating. Boy, if you had a story, wouldn't you tell the police? So what do you have to say about the part that I just read?
The part that you just read, they're referring, the stepfather is referring to a video of the victim post-crime, which is nothing to do with what's happening on the street that night, because they want to know who is the perpetrator, who should be arrested. The fact that after the fact, the victim who has had his face slashed is angry, making threats, and the family takes a video of him, the police apparently thought that that was something they should take to court. Maybe they would want to put it in evidence for some reason. But, you know, it had nothing to do with who's the perpetrator or not. If they had said,
telling me the police wouldn't have been concerned even if after the fact Urbanski was threatening to kill the family, that's
think
the way
when
these
you,
things operate in Jersey City? No concern about that?
I think when you're looking at a video of a man with his face basically, you know, sliced in half and bleeding, you understand his hysteria and shock. And by the way, Your Honor, our witnesses all admitted to that. Our witnesses testified that he was hysterical. He ran up in a rage on the porch. He threatened the family, and they had to, you know, grab his T-shirt and take him off the porch. So this isn't anything new. This isn't anything that has to be shown to the jury to rebut anything, because this was the evidence all along. Everybody testified about this on our side. So except for the detective who wasn't there, but both of our witnesses, the victim and his wife. This is, you know, something that was conceded. So I fail to see any prejudice to the defense by not having this conversation. Certainly the stuff about what's happening to defendant's car is irrelevant. You know, we don't know. This actually, I think the fact that the police officer out and out says they didn't call the police, we got one call, that actually shoots a few holes in the defense story, because they were all saying they called the police. So I don't think the video was at all helpful to the defense. And I think the prosecutor's summation was clearly responsive to the defense, commented on the evidence. What he said was pretty clear. I mean, maybe it's not, you know, maybe people wouldn't agree with the point. Well, they could talk to anybody. And that's true. If they ran up to one of those police officers and they said, look, we were being attacked by a mob, it's not like you think, this is what happened, then I would say, sure, put the video in. And also I would assume that those police officers on the street, had they heard that, yes, then they would have called, Dominich over, Detective Dominich, and said, you know, there was something leading up to this, so it's not, you know, it's not what it looks like or whatever. But they never said anything like that. And just
the
fact
that I don't want to prolong this. We're sort of like relitigating the whole case.
Mm-hmm.
Your argument is that the video was properly excluded, correct?
Yes.
And it was properly excluded because it was hearsay and it wasn't relevant to any material issue, correct?
Correct, yes.
The defendant's position is simply that it is relevant as to credibility, since this was two people with very different views of what happened that night and very different stories, correct? Forgetting all the other, we know they didn't see the fight. We know they only saw the aftermath. We know it's not relevant to what was happening in the altercation. Is it relevant to the credibility of the detective when they say nobody told me anything? Nobody came, there were no other witnesses to talk to. In other words, is it relevant to any issue of credibility with respect to any witness in this case, whether it's mom, stepfather, and mother, whether it's the investigator, is it relevant to any issue?
Well, I would say
credibility
does not support the credibility of the mother, does not support the credibility of the stepfather. It doesn't affect either way the credibility of the detective. The detective can be seen walking by and she's doing exactly what
that's
she testified
argument,
she was
that's
doing.
That's an argument yeah. about whether it does affect it. Based upon the defendant's assertions, is it relevant to credibility only because the parents said we tried to talk to them, but they wouldn't talk to us, and the investigator said nobody talked to us? Is it relevant to that? Just credibility. Forget the prosecutor's argument in closing. Forget about whether it was misconduct. Give them all the benefits of the doubt. Credibility is always an important issue at trial. Is it only on that one narrow point? If they really cared and things were really awful, wouldn't they have tried to talk to anybody? Is it relevant to that credibility issue?
Showing that they spoke to the police at all, they, just at...
Yeah, because, they tried to talk, hold on, they tried to talk to the police. And as Justice Albin said, the police said, take it to court. Kind of blew them off. Is that a credibility question that video bears upon? I don't care about what was said on the video. I don't care whether they witnessed the accident. I don't care what happened before. I don't even care what happened after. Just on the issue of the credibility of the detective and the parents on whether they spoke to anybody, is it relevant to that one credibility issue?
Well, taken completely out of context about what they said, just that they said, and even though that's not an issue at all in the case, because everyone acknowledged they may well have spoken to the police. Sure, you know, I guess anything that shows you doing something that everybody knows you may have done, because again, Your Honor, we did not contest at all that they spoke to police officers. That was the whole point of the prosecutor's argument. Yeah, maybe you did speak to police officers, but you should have gone to the detective. Or he didn't say you should have. He said you never did. And I think that's telling. And I think the jury should look at that. I'm not saying that everyone must accept that argument. I'm saying it's a legitimate argument, that it's based on the evidence, and that it's responsive. So this video...
Not saying it's not a legitimate argument. Does the video raise the question? When they go up to the officers, detectives walking around in the background, they go up to the officers and they try to tell them something about what happened. They were attacked or banging down the door. I forget, it came up on the porch, banging down the door. They try to tell them and the officer says, take it to court. Is it relevant to credibility either of the detective, police officer, the parents?
Your Honor, I don't think they were trying to
You're not the jury.
I don't understand.
I'm a judge. I'm sitting up there. I'm watching. You try to get in this video. Prosecutor's objecting. Credibility is always an issue. If it bears upon credibility and the jury's got to make a credibility assessment, it's always an issue. And I'm sitting up there as the judge. Prosecutor, does it in any way bear upon their story that we tried to talk to the investigator or tried to talk to the police officers? They blew us off, said take it to court. And the detective didn't talk to us, and we didn't try to talk to the detective because the officer said, take it to court. Is it pertinent to that issue, and is that a credibility issue? That's all I want to know. Yes or no?
I would have to say no. I mean, it doesn't support the credibility because it's a completely different thing
they're saying. Under 607B, Counselor. Doesn't it come in under 607B? Because everybody's talking about hearsay. Isn't a prior consistent statement admissible to rebut a charge of reason fabrication, which is what your prosecutor was arguing? Because we all be talking about 803 and how about 607B?
again, it is not consistent with their defense.
It doesn't have to be. 607B allows a prior consistent statement to rebut a charge of recent fabrication, which is what we have here. Why is it admissible under 607B?
I would say it's not a prior consistent statement. It's totally
sure it
off.
They said they spoke off. They spoke to the police, and your prosecutor said they didn't speak to the police. You would think if they were out there, they'd be talking to someone. So even though you're trying to differentiate, to distinguish one from the other, police and detective, the original statement was they didn't speak to anyone. Why is this admissible under 607B?
Your Honor, when we say didn't speak to the police or did speak to the police, it's about a specific thing. It's about our story. There are two stories here. There's the defense side and the prosecutor's side.
And the prosecutors are arguing that that you shouldn't be believed because they didn't go to police. And I'm saying to you, why isn't this video admissible under 607B to rebut the charge of recent fabrication that they're claiming that it's a recent fabrication that they spoke to the police? Or tried to speak to the police.
Because in this video,
607B.
Because in this video, Your Honor, they are not bringing their story of self-defense that they testified about at trial to the police. That's why we say it's irrelevant. Because we never denied the victim getting hysterical after the fact. That's not the issue.
You're answering different. I'm sorry. Either you didn't understand my question, you really don't want to answer it. You're not answering my question. So I'll let it go because it's getting late.
Anything you'd like to say in closing, Ms. Bartolome?
No, thank you, Your Honor. Thank you for listening.
Ms. Bloom, rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm going to rest on my direct.
Thank you. Thank you to all counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement.